Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Getting It Out podcast. That was Finland's Unearthly Rites. The track was called Ecdysis. It's the title track from their upcoming debut album that's going to be released on the great Prosthetic Records. They are a recent signee, and as you heard, they are brutal, caustic, and punishing death metal from Finland. A little black metal in there, a little bit of punk. It's raw and it's visceral. And you can expect to hear a whole lot more about them in the coming months. But that debut album, Ecdysis, is going to drop May 3rd, again on Prosthetic Records. There's a music video out for this song as well, if you want to go check that out. I'd highly encourage it. Dig in to the death metal, because that's what we're doing here this week on Getting It Out. Unearthly Rites was the first stop, and now we're going to Knoxville, Tennessee, to talk to Jamie Bailey of the great Brodequin. They got a new album, Harbinger of Woe, out now on Season of Mist Records, and it's been 20 years since their last, so we had a lot to talk about. But first, a little reprieve from the death metal onslaught from the thrash metal haven known as Hot Zone.
Kick it! Make family out of friends, make friends out of enemies. Peace to my family, make friends till they bury all the places we've been. We're never sitting it out, we be getting it in. Where you getting it out? I said all the places we've been. We're never sitting it out, we'll be getting it in. Where you getting it out?
So, like I said a minute ago, the plan is that there's a lot of death metal dropping on Getting It Out Podcast and gettingitout.net this week, if all things go as planned, that is, and they never do. But hey, I've got good intentions, brutal intentions, and ideas and plans and all those things. This episode is the first of those things. So if you like them growly, this is the week for you. Last night, I kicked it off with the opposite of death metal. Went with my wife to see Shovels and Rope, the South Carolina folk and country duo. They played in the town that I grew up in, York, Pennsylvania. So we took a drive over there, walked into what I know as the Strand Capitol Theater. It has since been renamed the Appel Center. They still call the theaters within the Strand and the Capitol. So it's a little bit confusing. And I was a little thrown off when I walked into the theater and sat down. And I thought, what the hell? This place has shrunk significantly. I saw Brian Regan in there last. That was the last thing I went there for. The great clean comedian. Always got to mention that he's clean. And then I realized, oh, this is the smaller. This is the Capitol Theater. That's why it was always called Strand Capitol. There's two theaters, like I mentioned. Anyway, this is not going to be news or anything to anybody who's not local. It was just kind of one of those things where you think you're familiar with something, real confident, walk in, sit down, you go, where the fuck am I? Anyway, Shovels and Rope were great. I bought handicap tickets because they were the only things that were left. And I figured, hey, they had as much time as I did to buy them. Let's be fair. I called the theater ahead of time and said, am I allowed to buy these? And they said, well, we can't tell you, you can't sit there. So I said, that's a yes. So I bought them. Front row seats for us. And nobody sitting beside us. It was pretty nice. And I can tell you that I looked at the other rows. People were sitting all the way up to the front on those. So other people did the same things. We're not the only one. At least two other people in a room of, I don't know, maybe 100. It couldn't have been that many people. Those were the only tickets available, though. So I guess essentially it was basically sold out except for a couple of handicaps. So as far as I'm concerned, we were doing everybody a favor by making that room look more full. Anyway, they were great. They were a little heavier than I was expecting, which is not meaning they're a heavy band in any respect. We were sitting right there, right up at the front against the speaker. Probably would have sounded better if we were back a little bit further. For those unfamiliar, it's a husband and wife duo. And again, it's folk music, essentially. There's country elements. There's some rock stuff, too. But what they do is pretty impressive. One person plays guitar, harmonica, sings. Typically, they alternate positions. And the other person sits on a drum stool and plays a keyboard, drums, maracas, also sings. Point is, it's an impressive display of instrumentation, which you automatically just like give them grace. And if they fuck up, you're like, hey, they're playing five instruments and singing beautifully. So it's okay. Anyway, it was a cool show. And I'm glad to have seen them in such an intimate setting. It's a band that I've been listening to for a long time, my wife as well, one that we enjoy together. So it was cool to check out before I smash my face and ears with death metal for the rest of the week. And that first scheduled smashing is 20 years in the making. Brodequin from Knoxville, Tennessee, dropped their new album Harbinger of Woe on Season of Mist Records just a couple weeks ago. Highly anticipated would be a fitting phrase. And boy, did they deliver. If you haven't heard it yet, I'd say you're slacking and I'd be right. So let's get to it. Let's make sure we move quick. I had a great conversation with Jamie Bailey. He was awesome. We sat down on a Sunday morning and he was a fucking joy to talk to. Almost as much of a joy as it is to listen to Brodequin. So let's go with a song from that new album. This one was the first single. It's called Of Pillars and Trees. And then my conversation with Jamie.
We'll be right back.
hydroxychloroquine, Jamie. It's been 20 years or so, or exactly 20 years since the last record.
Yeah, I guess so. You know, it's obviously, it definitely wasn't something we intended to do, is take a huge break. And we certainly didn't think if we take a break like that, we'll hit it right on the button of 20 years, you know, just kind of worked out that way. We ran into some difficulties, some family difficulties with multiple losses of family members in a short period of time. And it made it virtually impossible to focus on anything other than that. There was really no room for taking the time to try and get the creative juices flowing. Everything kind of revolved around dealing with that situation. And then once we were able to move beyond that, you know, we ran into some personnel issues and things of that nature. And then COVID happened, and it kind of slowed down the process. It made travel difficult, and we're spread out anyway. Not so much my brother and I, he only lives about an hour away, but with Brennan on drums, you know, he's out in Texas. So flying in to do things during that period was not the easiest of things to do. Sure. And so we just kind of, here we are now, you know?
Well, I think a lot of people are obviously glad that you're back. And I was surprised to see it pop up in my email when it did, the official announcement, the official album, with a word in it that I say wrong every single time. I've never in my life been able to decide or remember if it's Harbinger or Harbinger. Right. Please tell me.
Yeah. I say Harbinger.
Okay.
You know, I mean, I'm not, by no means am I saying that's the proper way to say it, but
nope, you are the authority because you named your album. So Harbinger of Woe. And, obviously the obvious question, I think is, why are you back? Why now?
Well, I think again, you know, with the previous discussion causing kind of the delay, it was, you know, we had never intended really to stop. You know, we ran into some issues, of course, like all bands do, you know, but we never really thought about taking a break. Then, you know, once you're gone for a certain period of time and you're able to kind of like start settling your mind back on music, so to speak, or the scene in general, if you want to call it that, you realize, you know, how much of an impact it had had on your life up to that point. And you realize that you want to get back into it and, you know, be involved again and contribute and so on and so forth. And, you know, it's difficult for bands in any capacity to make any kind of, you know, any kind of movement in this world with all the music that's out there. And then to be given basically kind of a second chance or a new beginning was a really amazing experience, you know. And once it started kind of percolating that we were doing things, the support from the fan base was incredible. And, you know, it's something that we'll never take for granted. And we thought, yeah, okay, there is room to do this again. There is room to put new music out.
I guess if you were aware of the support from the fan base, then you yourself stayed in touch with the scene while you were inactive as a band?
Yeah. I mean, we just kind of, you know, lurked in the shadows, so to speak. You know, we were watching what was going on. We were seeing the new bands that were coming out and so on and so forth. Although it was, it was definitely from a distance. We weren't really, you know, in there doing much. We knew that if we did kind of dive in there with everything else that was going on, we wouldn't be able to kind of give the attention to the band that it requires. You know, I mean, it takes a tremendous amount of time, as you're well aware, doing things like this, you know, just, you know, trying to get people in the same room is a challenge enough. And, you know, with everything else going on, we were in the distance, in the background watching, just kind of lurking there.
That whole, I say this all the time, but that whole, scheduling, arranging, aligning schedules with other people is exactly why I do everything by myself. It's not because it's easier. I mean, it is easier that way, but it's not because, but it's, you know what I mean? It's only easier in the, to get things done. It's a solo effort, you know?
Oh yeah.
No, it's harder to do, but it's easier to manage, I guess.
Yeah. I think so. That's probably a good way to look at it. It's definitely easier to manage or just managing your time. You know, so that's easier to kind of schedule yourself with things. When you get 2, 3, 4 other people involved, it starts to become a real pain.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Well, you keep it pretty minimum. Three people is about as few as you can go. I guess you could go less. You know, it could be a solo project. Yeah. It could be a duo, but three people. Have you found, actually I asked somebody else this recently on the trio thing. Does Brodequin have to be a trio to you?
I don't think it has to be a trio. I think it's just kind of worked that way, you know, mm-hmm. like, especially when we were first getting started here, there's very limited amount of people that are interested in death metal at all in this area. And then, you know, an even fewer amount of people that play the instruments you're looking for. So it just kind of worked out that way. And I guess, we've never actively thought about expanding the roster to, you know, include more people. It's just kind of the way we operate.
Sure. It works. Why fix it? You know, don't, yeah. whatever. What's that phrase? If it's not broke, don't fix it. Something like
that's
that.
Right. Yeah.
That's the one. Yeah. So, you're in this band with your brother, Mike, and that's a very cool thing, to me, as someone with a brother who doesn't do anything with my brother other than get together. I'm always envious when I see, siblings, sure. collaborating on something, especially something long-term. And mm-hmm. what I would, we use success in a relative term, right? Sure. For something right. like death metal, but in a right. successful way.
Yeah. It's a special thing, right? Like you said, it's, you know, Mike and I moved around the country a lot as kids, you know, every few years due to our dad's job, we were bouncing around, mm-hmm. you know, probably the longest we stayed in one spot for a while might've been like 4 years, something like that, but you were bouncing a lot. And so growing up, there were many cases where, you know, say you land somewhere in like June, you know, school's out. So you're not going to school right away. You're not going to go meet people. So there were many times where, you know, for a series of months, Mike and I were basically each other's only friends. Mm-hmm. So it kind of, when we started playing music, which Mike started way earlier than I did, but when we started playing music, it was just kind of natural for us to just play together. And it just has carried forward this whole time. Which is really cool. You know, it's a, like you'd mentioned, it is a special thing and you don't see a whole lot of it. Mm-hmm.
Do you remember what the catalyst for you guys going down the death metal rabbit hole was?
Oh, let's see. I would say, you know, you kind of hear these classic stories where people get, you know, Metallica, Megadeth, you know, whatever the early exposure is, you know, for some it was Black Sabbath or whatever the case may be. And you start kind of plunking around, you know, trying to learn these songs on guitar and, what was for me anyway, was the challenge of it. Like, okay, it's one thing to play Iron Man, you know, and then it's a whole nother thing to try and play, say, Master of Puppets. Mm-hmm. And then you stumble into the world of Morbid Angel and you're like, oh God, you know, how do I play this? You know, so that was the driving force. We were trying to, you know, basically build skills up and see how fast can we actually play? You know mm-hmm. what I mean? How fast can you go before you just can't do it anymore? It doesn't make any sense. And that was the thing. And of course, you know, early on, we had friends that played different instruments and, you know, we were in like not even really projects, just little goof off things with them. And then as those things fall apart, it became obvious, well, you know, you're literally in the bedroom next to me here. Why aren't we just writing music together? And right. that's kind of how that happened.
Yeah. No, a good place to be in, a good common bond to share and interest. I think it's super cool. So when you released, let's go back to the Instruments of Torture.
Yeah.
Was that immediately evident to you guys that you had something?
Well, you know, it's one of those things. And I often think about that when a band writes a riff, you know, that they mm-hmm. just know is good, you know, like they just know. And it wasn't immediate to me that there was something there. My kind of stance on it was, well, this is really cool and really fun, and it'll be great if people like it. You know, we thought, well, we'll play, you know, maybe some local shows and regional, but we never thought necessarily that it would go beyond that. Of course, you're hoping it will, but we never knew if it would or not. But yeah, once the album kind of got out there and was out there for a few months and people started talking about it, then we kind of recognized, hey, there's something here. You know, people are pretty into this, which was really exciting, you know, really, really cool, especially being we were coming at it with a little bit of a different angle. You know, we weren't doing the typical gore horror thing. Mm-hmm. You know, we kind of had a different thing going, and then the album cover was very different, you know, this old black and white woodcut type thing. And that part of it wasn't really immediately accepted. People would hear the music and say, okay, but then sometimes when they saw the imagery, they kind of took a step back, like, oh, wait a minute here. You know, what is this? Why is this black and white and not like, you know, some splatterific cover art?
Right.
And that just wasn't the way we were looking at things, you know?
That's interesting because that's like one of the big, one of the most intriguing things about Brodequin, and what, like the theme of your band, I think, is something that obviously easily sets you apart. And I think when we're playing death metal, that's necessary, or else, you know, you just kind of fall into the pack. Like a lot of bands, a lot of good bands don't stand out because it's kind of like the, you know, repeat by not only sound, but aesthetic, all that.
Yeah. That was, you know, something to me when we first got started was, okay, well, yeah, you know, you want to, obviously you want to stick out, you know, however you can. Mm-hmm. And being a history fanatic as I am, I thought, well, this is the way right here. You know, I mean, this is something that I can't believe hasn't been covered in depth up to this point. So it kind of seemed like this is natural for us. You know, we can take this and kind of run with it and kind of play the Iron Maiden of the death metal world, if you will.
Yeah.
Where, you know, the Iron Maiden would have these songs that would kind of tell you stories. And, you know, you could learn things from that. And I thought, well, this is the way we'll go. You know, this will maybe help us, you know, kind of stand out. And it served us well, you know, over the years. It really has. And from the beginning, we really wanted it to be kind of, you know, encapsulating our entire identity.
Yeah, and it's been done well. I think you've been successful in that way. And it's been kind of interesting to me that not many other bands have tried to match it despite your success with it.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things that makes it challenging is, and that's fine. You know, there's lots of death metal bands out there and lots of death metal fans that don't care about lyrics at all. And that's
totally right. Right.
You know, I get that. And then look, man, whatever floats your boat doesn't bother me in the slightest. So there is a challenge if you're writing about stuff like this to be writing about it from, you know, kind of a historically accurate perspective. Of course you can take liberties and make it more of a story. And, you know, you're assuming different things in the heads of victims or inquisitors, et cetera, you know. But another thing is there's a real kind of barrier when you're looking at the artwork itself. Sure, you can find endless images kind of dealing with Middle Ages online, but, you know, it's super low resolution. You're not going to be able to reproduce this for, you know, CDs, vinyls, and t-shirts. So having access to that kind of material is difficult. I think if more people did have access to it, we might see some more of that. But it is interesting. I've seen a couple bands using some of it, but not nearly as much as I would think, considering the brutality of the subject matter.
Right, right. Yeah, that's a good point, though, but the artwork. I never would have considered that, but you would, because you've thought this over.
I do. I think about it a lot.
Makes sense. It's your baby, you know?
Right, exactly.
The one thing I noticed looking back at the discography, and of course, a lot of time has passed, so there's been plenty of opportunity for it, but I see that whether it's Instruments of Torture, Festival of Death, Methods of Execution, all of them have been released by several different labels worldwide. So how did you end up coming back and landing on Season of Mist?
So the multiple labels thing was something that when it was happening was very interesting because, you know, especially now it's always been that way, but now shipping rates are just astronomical.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the last time I checked, I think it cost something around $17 to send a shirt to Germany, which is insane.
Yeah, I sent a record to somewhere overseas recently and it was $27 for one, I mean, one LP.
That's crazy, right? Yeah. Crazy. And I'm sorry. No, wait, I got mistaken there. It was $22, I think, for a t-shirt. It's $16 for a CD,
which is insane. Yeah.
Insane. So the only way to get it in the hands of other people was to kind of go in their regional market. Mm-hmm. If somebody was interested in releasing it on, say, cassette or whatever, we were like, yeah, sure, of course. Because that gets it in the hands of the people that are in that area, which to us is the most important part. You know, I mean, finances are extremely limited in this genre, as you're aware. So it's not like when you're striking these licensing deals, you know, you're putting a new Maserati in the garage, you know, you're just going ahead and getting your music in the hands of the people that want to hear it.
Yeah. Break even at best.
That's right. At best, you might be able to break even on some of these things. So that was the goal with that. And then they would approach us on it and we'd look it over. And to be honest, many, many times, you know, if it was cassettes or whatever the case may be, or if it was something out of Indonesia, you know, we would just say, yeah, you know, send us a dozen shirts or something. Mm-hmm. That's fine. Just go ahead and, you know, get those shirts into the hands of fans. Go ahead and do your thing. And then with Season, we actually met the owner and several members of the staff at Hellfest. And it was surprising to us how much they knew about us. Mm. We had known several bands on their label and followed their label and other labels throughout the years, of course. And they were very excited about the stuff we'd done in the past. They were very interested in what was coming up. So we kept them very much in the loop when we were doing things, and their excitement, you know, their enthusiasm about the new material when they were hearing it, there was really almost no choice for us at that point. You know, we were like, these guys are on the same page. They get it. We think it's a good fit. They think it's a good fit. Let's do this. And that's how we ended up there.
That's great. Especially to have your choice base essentially made for you. You know,
yes,
it's pretty awesome, you know, yes. But in a good way, of course, not right. Because your options were limited, but because it made no sense to go anywhere else.
We had some people that were interested and from different labels and, you know, the respected labels and people that, you know, we've known for years or labels we looked up to for years, mm-hmm. but everything just clicked for this. And it really was kind of one of those no brainer moments, you know?
Yeah, that's great. I love what Season of Mist does. There's such an array of stuff on that label. And I think they released my favorite death metal of last year with Horrendous's LP. Mm-hmm. There's always good stuff coming out on Season of Mist.
Consistently good. Yeah.
I got to ask you a question that I've asked other people that I see get hit with this Season of Mist underground activists. Uh-huh. I've asked other bands who are under that sub-label, and they don't know what that means. Do you know what exactly the underground activist sub-label is for, or what it means, or why, how it's different from Season?
I have noticed no difference at all in anything.
It's very consistent. Yeah.
Yeah. My thought on it is, and this is just pure speculation, you know, but my thought on it is maybe they're putting that tag on it for the things that are, you know, quote unquote, the more extreme, the more underground.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Traditionally more underground bands.
Sure.
You know, let's see what happens with some of the future releases they have coming up if they keep that going on certain bands like I think they will. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I don't have any insight on that at all.
I think you're right. I think it's almost like a nod of credibility to the more I'm going to say pretentious underground that doesn't typically accept something. They see something on a label like Season of Mist and they go, that's mainstream, you know, and
right.
Which is a silly group of people in my opinion, but whatever.
I know what you mean. Yeah. I mean, it is interesting. I mean, Season is able to get us in places like here right now, talking to you and many other places that we wouldn't have been before. And it's always interesting to me when I see people get a little bit upset that one of their bands that they've enjoyed is getting some kind of measure of success. Mm-hmm. I want all the bands that I know and I'm friends with and I'm fans with to do the best they possibly can.
Absolutely.
So I wouldn't be offended if any of those bands were all of a sudden, you know, if it's lucky, it's lucky, you know, meaning hopefully it works out for them. They get on a so-called major label or whatever. Good for you.
Yeah.
You know, that's fantastic.
Oh yeah. I mean, I was having this conversation somewhat recently within this year, at least with Hatebreed's drummer. What's his name? Matt Byrne. Mm-hmm. And we're just talking about how there's a, you know, Hatebreed's this big giant metal band now.
Yeah.
And they came out of the hardcore scene and it's always been like a crabs in a pot thing. Like, no, you got to come back down here. You're not supposed to be up there. You're supposed to be down here. And we've seen that happen with death metal, with every genre, essentially.
Of course. Yeah.
And it's interesting. I like it, but nobody ever wants to admit to being on the side of the people trying to bring it back, keep it down on their level. It's a strange thing. It's like Kid Rock sold millions of records and has zero fans. Come on. People are lying here. You know?
Exactly. Yeah. That's right. I know. It is a very strange thing.
Yes. All right. So the new record, The Harbinger of Woe, features 10 tracks. It's been 20 years since the last one. What would you say, if anything, is different about this record compared to the previous releases?
So the obvious would be the production. You know, in the past, and there's a little bit of a misconception that, you know, we were intending for it to sound as raw as it is, meaning the previous albums.
Yeah.
Now, sure, of course, you know, I mean, we were doing a lot of bare bones stuff as far as effects and stuff go. You know, we were in one hand kind of keeping it very much a raw, abrasive thing. But at the same time, we were really limited by the finances recording and the places where we were recording. So the obvious would be the step up in production. In addition to that, I would say we've kind of branched out a little bit, which is dangerous when you're talking about death metal. You don't want to say branch out or anything, you know, different, but people get excited, but there's, you know, no reason to get excited. Excuse me. We just branched out a little bit on some of the guitar writing. You know, we took a couple different approaches we hadn't done in the past, but in all honesty, so much of the stuff that's on this record was lined up to be the follow-up to Methods of Execution. There's a lot of stuff here that was just a natural evolution of the way we were going. We were experimenting a little bit more with the vocals, you know, and trying a couple different things there. So we had the guitar changes a little bit, a little more experimentation, a little more experimentation with the vocals. But again, it's kind of a natural progression for us. I think that a lot of people will feel that when they actually get to hear the whole album.
Yeah, I have to agree. I mean, I've listened to it quite a bit, and I was just listening to it while taking a pleasant run through my neighborhood, which is always funny to me to have, you know, death metal blasting in my headphones while running past several soccer tournament games of children, you know. But, you know, that's just the way it is here in the suburbs. But while I was running today, I was thinking about your vocals, and they have a certain depth to them. Right. And it's pretty impressive that you're able to pull them off. And it got to me thinking that it has been 20-ish years since you've done this. I know, of course, there's been practices and stuff, but was it hard or easy or nothing for you to get back that ability to do that kind of performance?
Yeah, that's a good question. I would say it probably took me, in all honesty, about 2 weeks. To get back to where I kind of was.
How do you do it? Just practice?
Yeah, that's it. You know, to be honest, it's going to sound, you know, pretty corny, but the way I would do it is I would do it like when I would drive home from work in the afternoon. You know, I'm in the car by myself. You know, nobody knows. I don't care anyway, but nobody knows when if they look over at a red light, if I'm talking on the phone or whatever.
Right.
But that was, to me, like the best way to do it. You know, I was in my own little private space, and any mistakes I'm making or pops and cracks that are happening are fine. You know, whatever, just go ahead and do it and kind of work it all back out and get it back to where it needs to be. And I think it was about 2 weeks, something like that. And then, getting back kind of in the practice room, you know, really started to speed that up a little bit.
That's similar for almost every vocalist I talk to has the same method. Just get in the car and work it out.
Yeah. Absolutely. And that's how I learned how to do it in the first place, was in the car coming home from work, you know, was just experimenting, trying to see how these guys make these crazy sounds. And that's what led me to it. So yeah, I think the car is like the ultimate rehearsal space.
It's true. It's true. And everybody's doing plenty of weird shit in their cars. So
absolutely.
A little grunting and growling isn't too bad, you know?
No.
Well, your brother is listed as the producer and sound engineer of this record. Does that make, I have to imagine, that makes life a little bit easier?
It does.
Making a record?
It does. You know, he's got his little studio there at his house. And so we did all the bass guitar and vocals there. And then Brennan recorded his drums out in Texas. And then Mike put it all together. And, you know, got basically everything lined up real nice, sent it off to Josh Welshman. He did his thing. And then he did a great job on that. He also did the EP beforehand. And then we sent it off to Audio Siege. who also did excellent work. And they sent us two different mixes, or he sent us two different mixes to listen to. And I thought, oh boy, here we go. You know, this will be the next challenge if we can all agree on which one we like the best. And shockingly to me, we all came back in and said, yeah, we like, you know, this one. Oh my God, that was easy.
That's great. That's great. That's exactly what you want.
That's what I want. That was nice. Yeah. It was painless as far as that goes.
Well, you obviously get along very well with your brother, but how does it work? How do you guys deal with each other? Is it as seamless, as easy when it comes to the recording?
Yeah, it's pretty good. You know, I mean, this was the best recording experience that I've had, you know, that I think we've had shared experience is in a lot of ways, you know, we're basically sitting next to each other when we're recording. If Mike's recording guitar, I'm sitting, you know, 5-6 feet away, and vice versa when I'm recording bass, and the same thing when vocals are happening, we're just right there. And it's cool. It's a supportive environment. You know, it's not weird in the sense where, you know, we're like staring at each other, you know, when we're recording. It's just, you know, you do your thing and I'll hit record and, you know, and, you know, here we go. So yeah, it's very relaxed, very, very laid back. It's a good environment to do this.
What are you most excited about for the release of this record?
I think that now people will actually be able to hear the instruments the best they have ever been recorded. You know, it's actually much clearer now. You can hear the riffs that Mike is playing. In the past, a lot of stuff would get lost in those recordings, and we'd play live and people would come up to me afterwards and say, my God, I didn't realize you were playing so much, or so much was going on in that song. So this time they'll be able to hear it. That's exciting for me. I know it's exciting for him. I think that's the big takeaway, is that you're actually going to be able to hear everything for once.
Do you anticipate getting back to the prolific pace that you had as far as releases when you first started?
I think it's in the realm of possibility. I know right now, because we had such a lag, you know, even though we weren't doing stuff, we still were writing riffs, you know, recording them when we could, you know, like in GarageBand or something, and just slapping them in a folder, you know, to come back and visit later and see if there's anything usable there, or something we can put together from it. Right now, I think last count, you know, I think there's 8 songs that are mostly complete. I say mostly complete because, you know, there's a lot of things that get changed, you know, tweaked here and there, but mostly complete. And that being said, you know, the I hate to call the side projects, it's really, but it is what it is, I guess. The whole liturgy thing, for those that are familiar with that, you know, there's 10 completed songs there. So there's a lot of material that we have. I don't foresee it taking more than, you know, really a year or two at most to punch out the next album.
It's kind of what I expected. It seems like that's the, you know, just looking at the beginnings, the way it was like 3 albums in whatever, 3 years or I don't know what, I don't have it in front of me, but you know, it was quick.
It was really quick.
It seems like you guys like to work that way. And when you have the means of which to do that, being that you're close relatively, at least two of you, and have a home studio, that you get back to it.
Yeah, I think, you know, and we work at it in different angles, you know, so as Mike, you know, maybe we have these great riffs or whatever, or whatever riff I come up with, I would never call great. Okay. Because I'm just not a great guitar player. I'm just not. It's very dirty, very rough around the edges. I bring it to Mike and he's able to craft it, you know, into kind of what I was going for, and in many cases, even better than what I was going for. So as he's working on that front, and maybe he's like, you know, I'm going to record a couple songs, so to speak, that we have kind of roughed out, I'm handling the other side of things, you know, trying to track down artwork and this, that, and the other. So being we don't have to, you know, rely on one person to do the majority of things, we can get, you know, a lot done in a fairly decent amount of time.
Right. Locally, what has been happening in Knoxville or Tennessee in general with the death metal scene? And I ask because I know that there's been an uptick in extreme music scene specifically in certain southern states. So, but I don't know if anything is coming to my mind surrounding Knoxville.
Knoxville traditionally, you know, has not had a very strong death metal scene. I know it's shocking to many out there, but it's just, it's just the way it is.
Not quite a mecca.
Not at all. No, but what's interesting is over the last couple of years, many more tours have been coming through than we've had in the past.
That helps.
It helps big time. So we go to all the shows, of course, just to support the promoters that are putting these things together, and the bands, obviously. But you know what I mean? The promoters that are putting it together, like, hey, it's worth your time. People will come to the show. And they've been doing pretty well. You know, one of the last shows that came through, you know, you had Cannibal and Dark Funeral, Immolation. That place was packed,
right,
which was really shocking, you know, because it had in the past, you know, if they would have come through, well, I can't say 10 years ago, but let's just say they did, there wouldn't be that turnout there. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty cool to see that happening and see more and more shows coming through. As far as the local scene and bands go, it's really not that much different than it was when we kind of first started. There's not a whole lot of bands around here, and the ones that are around here don't really play out a whole lot. And that's not because I'm saying they don't want to. It's just kind of a lack of having places to go. You don't really have these really cool, you know, little clubs, so to speak, that hold, you know, maybe 100 people. It's right. Either, you know, big or a coffee shop. You know what I mean? So there's, mm-hmm. You don't really have a whole lot there. But that being said, you know, there are some local bands that are punching stuff out on, you know, digital streaming platforms and things like that to try and make a name for themselves, which is nice.
That's cool. Yeah. And I understand what you're saying about you needing that mid-sized venue, yeah. That small, that it's more favorable to the underground. Mm-hmm. But has the opportunity to have slightly bigger shows. We recently got one of those around here, and it's a purely DIY run thing, and it's a beautiful thing to have back. And
yeah, nice.
Very cool. All right. So do you guys play often locally?
So funny thing is we've actually never played in Knoxville ever.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. But it's one of those things that over the years, you know, something might have popped up. And at one time, you know, all the members of the band did live here. Mm-hmm. But it just never worked out. When we played regionally, we played Chattanooga, Nashville, Memphis. We played all the bigger cities in Tennessee, except for Knoxville. Mm-hmm. And you know, again, regionally, as far as, you know, South Carolina and all that stuff, it's just not worked out here. Now with shows coming through more frequently, like they are, it's totally possible. You know, if something came through like, hey, we'll jump on this and see what we can do. Yeah. Brennan would just come out and we'd take care of that. Which would be funny because it'd be the first time we played here.
That's funny. I should have asked this earlier, but I just thought about it. It's not necessarily in line with what we were just talking about, but what does your family think of your band?
My mom and dad were, so funny story is our grandfather was a bluegrass player. Mm-hmm. Okay. And he played multiple different stringed instruments, which is kind of how we got into it. You know, as far as playing instruments goes,
yeah.
He had this wonderful little back room where he had, you know, guitars and banjos and mandolins and things like that. And we'd just go back there and plunk around, not knowing what we were doing, but just goofing off, you know? So mom and dad were kind of into, like, I remember being very young and like they were into Alice Cooper and Led Zeppelin and Black Sabbath and things like that. And so that's kind of, they were kind of the beginning of getting into, you know, metal. Right. Mm-hmm. But I mean, that being said, you know, I listened to all kinds of stuff. It wasn't like they were metal heads at all. It's just that part of their collection had hard rock, heavy metal, if you will. So that was our first exposures. And when we started doing this, it was kind of funny because our grandfather didn't understand it at all. Like, you know, what are you doing? He's thinking we're like destroying the instruments because of how they sound, you know?
Yeah.
And I remember Mike just like, you know, trying to pull his hair out. Like, no, it's fine. You know, look, if I just turn the pedal off, you know, it sounds fine, you know? And that was kind of a funny thing. Mom and dad were just, they were cool with it. They didn't totally understand it, you know, but they weren't opposed to it either. You know what I mean? They didn't go, oh my God, you know, what you're doing is, you know, like you're worshiping the devil and, you know, this, right, that, and the other, and you're going to be a serial killer. No, there was none of that. They just let us do what we were doing. In fact, our dad was really instrumental in the first album. You know, he really helped us financially get that thing printed because, you know, it was all self done, you know, self-released, yeah, everything. And at the time, again, going back, finances were so tight that, you know, once we had spent every penny we had to get it recorded and traveling there and this and that, and it was extremely affordable because the guy that recorded the first two albums was friends with our drummer. So, you know, it was extremely affordable. It was just traveling there and back and, you know, having no money at that point in life. We had ourselves a fully recorded album that was ready to go, and we had no money at all to manufacture it. You know, so we're just sitting on it like, well, what are we going to do? You know what I mean? So we're, you know, saving. And then my brother had had a conversation with our dad about it. And he was like, yeah, okay, fine. You know, I'll help you out and do this. So there was support there for sure. I mean, that being said, they let us set up in the our practice room. Our original practice room was right there at their house, you know. I say their house was our house, you know, but so they were supportive. They just didn't necessarily truly understand, you know, what we were talking about. To them, you know, it would have been back when we were kids and they were experiencing like Metallica with us. And they were mm-hmm. like, you know, what is this all about? You know, but they were never weird about it. And I've heard, you know, lots of different stories. I'm sure you have too, you know, with all the people we talk to, sometimes their parents are not supportive at all.
Yeah.
And it's even more of a struggle, as if it's not a struggle enough, you know, then they've got that to deal with.
Yeah. It kind of always goes, one of two ways. There's rarely indifference. Mm-hmm. There's either support, like you sounds like your parents. It's like you sounds like you had best case scenario where, yes. Especially in the end, when your dad ends up helping finance the record.
Yeah, you're right. That's a way to put best case scenario is a great way to put it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's awesome. Glad to hear that. And I'm sure that, I don't know, that's very cool.
It is cool. Yeah. I mean, it's one of those things where, again, like I said, they didn't necessarily, you know, they weren't fans of the music by any stretch of the imagination.
But they supported their kids.
But they supported their kids, which is awesome.
Right. As a parent myself, that's sometimes that's all you got to do.
Sure. I mean, that's great.
Yeah, you know? I mean,
yeah, it was really good. And then, you know, that being said, everyone we've kind of dealt with, you know, the drummers that we've had throughout the past, they have experienced that too, you know, to one level or another. That I don't know anyone that we've worked with, meaning in the band, mm-hmm. that had the opposite situation where they had no family backing at all, which is nice, you know.
That is that's very cool.
Yeah, it certainly makes. I mean, you know, you're dealing with a dozen other struggles at any given time, mm-hmm. you know. So at least that isn't there. That would be very hard to deal with.
Yeah, especially when you have a passion for something that you love, and if you have people that you care about telling you, you know, it's not worth it or don't do it or, you know,
right.
shitting on it. That's a bummer. So it's great when certainly. You got people in your corner.
Yes.
No matter how uncool that sounds, I stand by it.
Well, it's true though. Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, you wouldn't want to be in that situation where you're just getting dumped on totally by your mom and dad for something you actually enjoy doing.
Right. Yeah, of course. Of course. I got to remind myself that sometimes around here, but I'm sure that will continue.
I'm sure.
All right. So last one I got for you, and that is the record comes out on the 22nd. Mm-hmm. And then what's happening, or what can you say is happening with Brodequin for the rest of, let's say, the year?
Sure. So the only real official thing going on right now is we'll be at Maryland Death Fest, which will be exciting. I believe Season's going to be there themselves. There's a couple other Season and Miss bands playing there. It should be fun. There is chatter here and there about different fests overseas, which would be great. Mm-hmm. The big challenge with that right now is a lot of the promoters over there and several bands I've talked to have kind of similar experiences. They're a little bit hesitant to pull the trigger on it because the fluctuations in travel expenses.
I've heard that's been an issue over the last couple of years.
It has been. Yeah. So, you know, that's kind of, it's unpredictable. You know, I don't know what's exactly going to happen there. Hopefully it'll work out and we'll be able to get a couple of the fest overseas in. But that's about it right now that I can think of.
Hey, that's enough.
Yeah. Right.
A new album and a couple of shows. I mean, that's the whole thing, right?
That's right. Yep. That's right.
All right. Well, Jamie, hey, I'm glad you guys are back, and I know plenty of other people are as well. Actually, I asked a friend of mine who he was excited about at Death Fest, and you were among the first bands on his list. I know it's, you know, just as an example of, it's not just, it's there's excitement around you guys coming back, which is very cool. There's not always a ton of excitement on a death metal band. I don't mean that exactly how it sounds. I just mean, people don't like to show their excitement, I think.
Sure, and I get that. No, it's very exciting. Yeah. We're super excited about it.
So there you have it. That was my conversation with Jamie Bailey of Brodequin. The song you just heard was Suffocation in Ash. Of course, that's on the new album Harbinger of Woe, out now, available everywhere on Season of Mist Records. The band's not missing a step 20 years later, so please go check them out. Whether that's in your headphones or on a stage somewhere nearby, wherever they end up playing or not playing, who knows? Take advantage of them while they're here. Again, big thanks to Jamie for his time, for his conversation, for his musical output. And thanks to you for listening this far along in the podcast. I mentioned it several times. It's a lot of death metal this week, so please keep coming back. There'll be more tracks, interviews, and news right here on Getting It Out Podcast and on gettingitout.net, where you can check out what I got going on over there. You know the address, gettingitout.net. That's it. But of course, follow along on social media. You can essentially follow one place. That's the Instagram, @getting_it_out_podcast, for all things Getting It Out Podcast. I really wish I could have just had the Getting It Out username on Instagram, but that thing was taken many years ago. And of course, that account has like one post. I wish I could kick them out and take it and say, hey, give me that. I'll take that. Anyway, I can't. Okay, it's time to end this one. And of course, we should end with a death metal track. Instead of going down south, though, like we just were in Tennessee, let's go up north to the frozen tundras of Canada. There's a tech death metal crew named Proto Sequence. They just put out a new album called Bestiary out on Lacerated Enemy. It came out April 5th. And I want to play you that album's lead off track. It's called Sam. Thank you for listening. Bye-bye. Understand what it is. Love at me. No one was for you.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.